Okay, so I am Miriam Vega. I am the executive director of the AIDS Project of the East Bay, and I'm here to talk about HIV stigma in social media, the double-edged sword of information dissemination, specifically looking at how HIV is portrayed in Twitter. And if you have Twitter on your phone, please tweet so that way I can collect more data. Okay, so I have no financial disclosures. Okay, so in the HIV field, the last few years, we've been talking a lot about how we are very, very close to reaching the end of AIDS. People have put it out there that we can reach the end of AIDS by 2030. And currently, we have about 36.9 million people worldwide who are living with HIV, of which only 54% know that they are infected. One of the main reasons that the rate is still low, and one of the main reasons why we still have a way to go to end HIV/AIDS, is because of stigma. We have the biomedical tools to get to zero new infections. However, as the past UNAIDS executive director, Peter Piot, noted, tackling stigma and discrimination is one of the five key imperatives for reaching success in the HIV field. Stigma stops people from getting tested, stigma stops people from getting care and staying on treatment. So where we're at in the field right now is with three main questions. Where are we with stigma? How can we measure community or societal stigma? And can we use social media as a tool to mitigate stigma? A lot of people have talked about how social media is the new way to decrease stigma, because many individuals talk about how information dissemination is a way to lessen stigma. Well, what happens when you put information about HIV out in the social media world? Stigma, just very quickly, as many of you know, is to negatively devalue attributes, entails rejecting, teasing, and ostracism. Is often perceived moral transgressions, purity of body, pulling one's weight. And there are certain key emotions tied with stigma: disgust, anger, and contempt. And these three emotions will be ones that we will be looking at more so in a few seconds. So what is Twitter? I think many of you know, but it is a real-time information network that connects you to the latest stories, ideas, opinions, and news. It's what made Kim Kardashian famous, right? It's a microblog, it's part of the social media arsenal, it's a way to get people's attention, and in a way, it's kind of like, what is that called, Speaker's Corner in Hyde Park. You can go on to Twitter and just scream your head out. And there's something called clout as well, which is when you get retweeted. You put something out and you get retweeted, or you have more followers, then you start developing clout out there in the social media world. Interestingly, not many tweets out there actually get retweeted. I know a lot of people think everything gets retweeted. Not many do. A good less than 5% of the tweets out there get retweeted. And there's very little reciprocity as well in Twitter. You can put something out and it just hangs out there. Oftentimes a lot of people don't react. So oftentimes you truly are just screaming out into the great big void. So with that, does Twitter matter? It can, in certain cases. Past research has shown Twitter is a legitimate and frequently used communication channel and accurate predictor of public sentiment for a variety of topics, from public health to politics to brand awareness. Many of you may have heard of hashtag activism when we had Bring Back Our Girls. Also, Black Lives Matter. Those are examples of current hashtag activist campaigns. I do want to note one quick thing about Twitter, if I can go back for 1 second. In the public health field, they have been able to track flu outbreaks using Twitter. And they've been doing that by looking at uses of the word flu, headache, and so forth. And when they've been able to track that, when they've looked at that, they have had a 94% success rate in tracking flu outbreaks. So Twitter can tell you a bit of what's going on out there in the world. And it is oftentimes a good predictor of who's going to win the next election. So something to keep in mind. So with all that, we wanted to look at how HIV is seen in the Twitterverse. What sentiments surround HIV and how the sentiments change during a focused media campaign. In this instance, the focused media campaign was that of the International AIDS Conference that occurred in Washington, D.C. in 2010. At that time, Twitter was starting to become really big, and of course, the conference, just like the one here, had its own hashtag, and so we were following that hashtag as well, as long as tweets that had the words AIDS and HIV in them. We collected over 1 million tweets using a public Twitter streaming API, and we did this 23 days before the conference, during the conference, and after the conference. And we collected data about the tweet, the number of words, the number of retweets, and the content in them, as well as data about the person tweeting, so how many followers they had and how many people they follow. In collecting the data, we then brought it down to just English language tweets and tweets that weren't just garbled words, and we brought it down to about 250,000 tweets. We then did what's called polarity coding using sensitive WordNet software, which assigns to each word 3 scores in terms of polarity: positivity, negativity, and neutrality. For the most part, most tweets that are out there in the Twitterverse, they're fairly neutral tweets. And then for each word, we then created a summation of each word score for polarity. We then also did a sentiment analysis using 9 stigma-related emotions. So we used Paul Ekman's 7 basic emotions, and then we looked at one specific to stigma. And these were disgust, surprise, anger, fear, happiness, sadness, amusement, which is also contempt in this study, shame, and pride. And then we taught the machine how to analyze these words for their emotions using psychometrically validated text samples. So here are some examples of the scoring of some of the texts out there. So I'm just going to read one to you. Some of these are quite hateful, so these are not my words. These are the things that were out there. But the top tweet, "I hate you, you hate me, Barney gave you HIV. It started with a kiss, but then he wanted more. You got raped by a dinosaur." So then these were scored, and the main emotion in this one that was detected by the machine was anger. And then you'll see some of these other ones showing amusement, fear, and disgust. Okay. So then we wanted to look at the impact of this media and public discourse. These are some of the data about the tweets. On average, there was 15.9 words. I don't know if you're all familiar, but with Twitter, you're limited to 140 characters. So there aren't that many words you can put into 140 characters. Interestingly, there was a 34% retweet rate here, which is way higher than you see in any of the other literature or on average for tweets. So it showed that when during this time period when a lot of people were putting out information about HIV, there was a high response rate and engagement rate during this time. So the biggest emotion that was detected was that of disgust. That was the number one emotion associated with tweets surrounding HIV and AIDS, followed by amusement, anger, and sadness. If you look at these top emotions, they're all stigma-related emotions. And another example of disgust, we have a quote there, "Think I may have caught AIDS too. They were vile creatures, ew, ew, ew." And those were the type of tweets that were being put out during this time of the International AIDS Conference. So in terms of polarity, the top bar, the light blue one, is negative polarity, and the bottom one is positive. And then you'll see pre-International AIDS Conference, during, and post. What I'd like to draw your attention to is that the negative tweets started a little low, and then they just kept going, and they even stayed 2 weeks after. So there was a bit of a hangover effect from the International AIDS Conference. During the conference, you'll also see there was some increase of positive tweets, probably from individuals, advocates attending the conference who were putting out information. But I'm going to draw you now to the next slide, where we look at the specific emotional states expressed. And in terms of anger, which is one of the more salient emotions throughout this study, it increased during the International AIDS Conference. And during the International AIDS Conference, it's also when you had the most number of neutral tweets. And by neutral tweets, those were usually those that were just basic information dissemination, such as, you can get HIV this way, this way, and this way. Or, you know, now the largest group impacted by HIV are young gay men. So those type of very factual-based tweets increased also during the conference at the same time that anger expression increased. In terms of anger, we also did a sub-analysis and found that there were two types of anger being expressed. One was anger at the individuals that were impacted by HIV. So if you saw a tweet that said, the largest group now impacted are young gay men, there were a lot of tweets in response that were blaming the young gay men and showing anger towards them. But there's another subset of anger tweets, and those were the advocacy-related, the social justice tweets that were saying, how can we let this happen? Let's do something. Let's get angry. So you found this confluence of anger coming about during the International AIDS Conference. In terms of amusement, I'll also draw your attention to that. Amusement is also contempt, and it definitely increased enormously after the conference. Again, another hangover effect of sorts from the conference. So after the conference ended, people were still talking about it, but in a very derisive manner. So I'm going to walk you through a little bit of how do we predict these stigma-related tweets that are out there. Again, remembering that these top emotions found in the tweets were disgust, amusement, anger, those related to stigma. And what we looked at is we did some hierarchical linear regressions to see what are the various spaces of influence that impacted the emotions that were expressed. So we looked at the virtual communication space, such as word count, excuse me, then the chronological space, so the time around the International AIDS Conference during, pre, during, or post, and then the sphere of influence, how many followers and how many friends, or in this instance, well, we're using the word friends here, but it means also how many people you follow, and how those different spaces predict whether amusement, surprise, and disgust and fear are expressed. And in this here, all the models were significant. And you will see, interestingly, for anger, which is kind of that navy blue bar, it stands out in contrast to the other models in that the number of individuals that follow you, so the more individuals you had, the more anger you express. However, if you're following a lot of people, you're less likely to express anger. So in a way, it's kind of a megaphone effect. If you have a lot of people, you're going to express a lot of anger. But if you're also following people, then you become a little bit more subdued and perhaps a little bit more conscious of your public persona. And then we created a stigma score of the disgust, anger, and contempt emotions. And we also did another hierarchical linear regression. And we found that this model was predictive, but again, you find that if you're following a lot of people, you're less likely to express stigma. So I think there's something here around public self-consciousness that needs to be explored a little bit more. Okay. So in conclusion, the International AIDS Conference that occurred in 2012 had an immediate and specific effect in the public sphere. I should note that this conference in 2012 was the very first time that the conference occurred on U.S. soil. It has always occurred internationally, and it came to the U.S. in 2012 because that's when we lifted our ban on allowing HIV-positive individuals to enter the country. So we did have this ban until recently here. We also found that Twitter as a channel to measure stigma can be done. It can be a good tool for researchers out there. This was a bit of a proof of concept study. And we also did find that there's a double-edged sword to awareness campaigns. So right at that moment that we disseminated a lot of information about HIV/AIDS, it also increased anger towards those most impacted. So if we're looking to enhance our public health campaigns out in social media, we need to think a little bit more as to how we frame it so it doesn't become a blame situation. And recognizing that Twitter can unleash the power of anger, and we've seen many people taken down by Twitter, and we can see en masse that it can have an impact also on public health. And with all social media campaigns, if you should see some of this double-edged sword aspect to any campaign you're doing, you have to always have a contingency plan in place should the conversation not go as you had planned it to. And with that, I thank my collaborators. Couldn't have done this without the support of our programmer and also our data analyst. So thank you very much.
Does anyone have any questions for Miriam?
How did you do the computer programming logic tool to analyze the data?
As I said, I couldn't have done it without the programmer. and I have to say that we grabbed these tweets, number one, before they cut it off. So now if you want to do research with Twitter, you have to talk to Twitter and get permission to use the data and probably pay. We grabbed these from a public stream before they put in that cutoff. And so we grabbed the tweets, and we had to have a special server for it because it was a huge amount of data. And then the person programming it, Aaron Dawa, he taught the computer. So this was part of his own thesis. And so he taught it to do sentiment analysis and understand language. I can't go more in detail into it because I'm not a programmer. But it was a lot of machine learning. So we had to have a period of about 3 or 4 months where it learned to detect sentiment. And we then looked at the data and said, oh, this doesn't look quite right, and keep retraining the computer.
And then once it learned it, how long was it fast to analyze, or is
It was very fast. Once it learned it, you know, the data is very simple. And so we were able, we had to clean the data. There were some buggy aspects to it, but it took about a week or so to clean the data, and then thereafter we could analyze the data literally in a week. It was very, very fast after that. Yeah, but it's a lot of data.
Any other questions?
So I have a question for Dr. Margaret. So on the APHA website, there are some PDF documents uploaded that I think are, it looks like a framework for storing data, or I mean like at least an organizational.
Yeah, two of the ones with the words blank in them. One is a simple version of a table I use to track what I'm going to do with the data for a project. The other one's a more complicated project blank that I use when I'm building my own data set in, say, Access, in a database management program or an MEInfo with fields like columns on field details, is it a drop-down, what are my answers for the drop-down, that kind of thing. The other two that have notes in their file name, one is just some things to think about when you're doing data, if you manage to think about it before your project starts, and let's be real, a lot of us think about it later. And the other one is about, okay, so the project started and I got tagged with doing the analysis and evaluation, and now what do I do? So that looks more at how to do your data management when reality has intruded on what we would like for the ideal.
So the MEInfo, does that give you a template as to where you're storing data, or do you have to start kind of from scratch on that?
MEInfo actually is built on top of Access, and it's built on top of Esri Maps. So it has a mapping, basic mapping built-in component, and it has an Access database. And if you're an Access user or programmer, you can actually get into that database and reconfigure if you want. It takes a little practice. But for those of us who don't want to be Access programmers, MEInfo will build your Access database for you and give you a nice, essentially form-looking front-end survey, they call it a survey, form that you can do your data entry. And I use that a lot for if I'm going to be doing data entry over time, because I can make it look nice and I remember what my fields are, or if I'm having somebody else doing my data entry. And then I can pull out the data out of the back end and either dump it into MEInfo if I want to do epidemiological analysis, or I can dump it in Excel and do my own more basic analysis.
So this is more for quantitative analysis?
And MEInfo will actually take in words, but you can quantify the words. So it was built originally for doing outbreak analysis. So you can, you know, put in the 200-word list of foods they ate,
okay.
You know, kinds of stuff. So you can do that kind of thing. You can also, I've used it as a holder, just to hold my information and then pull it out someplace else. And Access will do the same thing. Access I tend to use more if I'm doing qualitative, but I can build my own databases. Not all of us want to go there. If I don't want to build my own databases, I'd probably go for paper or get a programmer for qualitative. There also are some other qualitative databases out there you can purchase. I like to do my own coding. I don't want the computer to code for me. Dinosaur, what can I say? And in which case I use Access, and I actually build my code dictionaries and code codes right within Access and build the code books that way so I can go forward. And that's probably the low-tech way of doing it in some ways. So I can track my own code books that way. Other questions? Other questions for the other ladies too?
I have a question about the app development. I'm working on a project as well that has an app, and we as researchers have a timeline of testing and thinking and yada yada. The world of apps, it's like tomorrow there's a new app, and if yours isn't the hottest, newest, best looking, whatever, so what? Where's our place as researchers? Well, we tend to be slow, but the reality of that world is very, very fast. And so where do we come in and, be more realistic in terms of the potential of our skills in this arena?
Well, going to mobile health conferences and whatnot, they always tell us to partner with developers and partner with the business side starting early on. And as much as that is supposedly a frustrating process, I haven't really done it myself, it really helps you position your app to be more successful. And thinking, you know, for researchers and we're working in academic spaces, that we could actually partner with providers to prescribe apps. And that's something that has some potential, so we can get things out that way. So I think we have to be a little more creative. We are slower. We're a lot more thorough. You know, usability testing in, you know, a company would take something like a couple months, you know, a couple of iterations to get it where they want, and then they're ready for beta testing. So we've been slower. It's taken us 2 years to develop our app. But yeah, I think developing appropriate partnerships is really important. Any other questions? All right, I think you guys just earned yourself a longer break. Thank you for coming.